Welcome to the Mental Health Podcast, a series of interviews with figures in the world of psychology, asking them about their fields of interest, opinions, and published works. I'd like to introduce the editor, Anna Motz, who is a consultant clinical and forensic psychologist with Thames Valley Forensic Mental Health Services. She has particular interest in psychoanalytic approaches to understanding and treating violence and self-harm. She is the past president of the International Association for Forensic Psychotherapy and the author of The Psychology of Female Violence, Crimes Against the Body, as well as the soon-to-be-released Managing Self-Harm, Psychological Perspectives. Managing Self-Harm will be essential reading for all mental health professionals, including clinical psychologists, psychotherapists, psychiatrists, psychiatric nurses, and social workers. Information about ordering and details of free sample chapters are available at the end of this podcast. Good afternoon, Anna. Thank you for coming in. Could you please start off by telling us briefly about your training and background?
I'm a clinical psychologist and I've been working for nearly 20 years in forensic services. So I work with people in secure units, which includes men and women who committed crimes or acts of violence for which they've been convicted. I also see outpatients in the community, some of whom haven't committed crimes but have fantasies about violence, and many of whom harm themselves. I also appear in court as an expert witness in child protection cases.
Could you tell us what prompted you to write your new book, Managing Self-Harm?
Yes, in my clinical experience with people who were violent towards others, I also noticed that many people were violent towards themselves. And this included people who had not actually acted on their fantasies about harming others, or people who were in the community living quite ordinary lives. So I noticed that self-harm was a really common problem. And it had this incredible kind of power for people. They wanted to stop, but they couldn't. And I was aware that it served huge, complicated functions, had tremendous significance for people. And I really wanted to understand what it was that led people to do things like burn their skin, cut themselves, insert glass into their bodies. So I became very interested in that question. And I suppose it was also that I saw how difficult it was for other people, like clinicians, to deal with self-harm, that it raised such powerful emotions for us and also for families and family members. So the whole issue of why it was that people started self-harming, why they continued to self-harm, and how they could use other forms of expression rather than something so destructive became a real fascination for me.
Which audience do you think the book will appeal to?
I think there are three categories of people who the book will appeal to. Firstly, there are clinicians, so all kinds of people who professionally come into contact with people who self-harm. Psychotherapists, counsellors, psychologists, probation officers, social workers, nurses, doctors, GPs, as well as psychiatrists, and also youth workers. All those people can find self-harm a really distressing and baffling kind of phenomenon and really want help not only in understanding how to deal with people who self-harm and help them, but also how to manage their own responses. The other two categories are the families and carers of people who self-harm, who often really struggle to understand what causes and maintains self-harm, and also find their own responses to self-harm very difficult to manage. Thirdly, I think this book will appeal to people who self-harm, who find their own behaviour, their own reasons for self-harming quite mysterious. I think a part of them really wants to stop, but there's another very strong part of them that feels compelled, if you like, to carry on self-harming. And it has served a very powerful function for them. So I think this book, by using the voices of people who self-harm, as well as clinicians, will appeal to people who self-harm.
You make particular reference to women who self-harm. Could you expand on this?
Yes, in my earlier book, The Psychology of Female Violence, I looked at how women typically use their aggressive impulses and turn them against themselves or their children. So self-harm is one mode of expression for women, and we know that it's more common in women and in adolescent girls than it is in men. It seems to have tremendous symbolic significance, and women seem to be inscribing their pain and their trauma and encoding memories really on their flesh. This can have major consequences for women. For example, we know that women move into situations of high security often because of violence to themselves rather than violence to others. So self-harm can mean that they're detained for longer in situations of restriction. I felt it was really important to explore the experience of women who self-harm and also how they have managed to stop at times when they have. So there are four chapters in the book devoted to the experiences of women. And I've also co-authored a chapter in which a woman who used to self-harm describes her own experiences.
You mention the complex and often subtle and meaningful interactions between those who engage in self-harm and their carers, and those who want to understand it. Could you tell us a little more about this relationship?
Yes, self-harm is fundamentally a relational activity, so I see it as an activity that requires a response. Sometimes a woman or a man can self-harm as a way of encoding a memory for themselves, but most often it seems to signal and communicate to other people that there is something that needs to be expressed. Because of the powerful feelings that self-harm evokes in other people, it can be very easy for professional and family members to get drawn into patterns of relating to self-harmers that are in fact quite destructive. So for example, on a ward, you can see a woman who self-harms being treated with a degree of overprotection or sometimes neglect or punishment. And if you understand more about her history, you'll realize that what's happening is that staff are unconsciously recreating patterns from the past. And she's once again like that helpless child who's either being abandoned and neglected or, you know, having all responsibility taken away from her and kept like she isn't even a person, but like a kind of object. And I think because we all get drawn into those patterns, it's really essential to think about the meaning of self-harm and the meaning of our own responses. A book like this describes typical responses that carers and professionals have when confronting people who self-harm and facing their own reactions. That's a way, really, through reflection, of understanding what self-harm produces in other people, the communication it really powerfully conveys. And then we can find a way to respond to self-harm that's going to break the cycle, that's not just going to repeat destructive patterns from the past.
You write about the meaning of self-harm. Could you say a bit more about this?
I see self-harm primarily as a silent language, so that its main function is to communicate. As I've said, communicating to other people is a central function of self-harm, but sometimes it has very private meaning for the person who self-harms themselves. So sometimes people start to cut at times when they're being abused, and nobody else other than the abuser knows about what's happening, but they're signifying, they're writing in their own flesh to preserve the fact that something is happening, to make something private public in a way. So the meanings can be very different for people. They can have all kinds of private symbolic significance, but I think it's almost always a way of communicating that something very important that maybe can't even be put into words, but is being embodied, really, is being written on the skin, written on the body.
How does this book differ to other books on self-harm?
This book is almost a combination of memoir and research. It has contributions from a range of authors, many of whom are clinicians, although one person is a woman who was a self-harmer and is now a musician and a poet. The authors come from a variety of backgrounds, and all of us are looking at self-harm as something that communicates, that isn't just pathological, parasuicidal behavior, but is actually something much more hopeful than that. It's a way of testing the environment to see whether the environment and other people can contain feelings and communications that are being expressed. So in a way, it's a much more hopeful view of self-harm, although none of the authors deny that it can have serious and even fatal consequences. But we very much look at self-harm as something that has a function, has a powerful self-preservative function for people who do engage in self-harm. One of the main features of this book that makes it different from other books on self-harm is that the authors write primarily from a psychodynamic viewpoint. We explore the meaning of self-harm, both consciously and unconsciously, and really try to understand it in symbolic terms. It looks at high-risk populations as well, and I think it's different in terms of the selection, the way that we view self-harm in this really much more hopeful way as a communication.
Thank you for joining us today. For more information about Anna's latest book, Managing Self-Harm, please visit www.routledgemental.com/Anna-Motz/managing-self-harm.asp, where a sample chapter can be downloaded and the full book can be pre-ordered. You can listen to and subscribe to more podcast interviews at this same address.